left ankle and foot were broken. Her skin had been punctured by bone. Her pelvis and tailbone were fractured. She had a compound fracture in her left arm. 9 of her ribs were fractured. Her sternum was cracked. Her lungs were punctured. She had lacerations to her liver, kidneys, and lower intestines. But the doctor reassured her. He told her that he thought she was going to make it. Hello, everyone. I'm Pamela Brewer, welcoming you to this edition of Mind Talk and welcoming you to this conversation with today's guest, Amy Ross. Amy is an award-winning educator who has been a high school English teacher for the past 25 years. Her writing has been published widely, and today she joins us to talk about her memoir, Permanent Marker. Hello, Amy, and welcome to Mind Talk.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Now, you heard me begin the program with a description of the condition that you were in at one point in your life. When you hear the explanation, does it still bring up anything for you, or do you feel like you've kind of moved away from it?
No, actually, as you started saying all those words, and I started, there was a checklist that began in my head, and it's always amazing to hear all of those injuries when they're listed like that. It's crazy to me that you can have those injuries and you can come back from them.
It is absolutely stunning that you can have those injuries. And of course, the doctors, when they told you they thought you would make it, weren't giving you the high five that one might have hoped for.
No, it was a strange moment that I still remember. And of course, you know, that was probably the morning that I was the most awake after everything that had happened. So I was, you know, to be fair, I was coming off some pretty heavy duty pain meds of intensive care, but here's this doctor who lists all of my injuries and then gets up and says, "Well, we think you're going to make it." And I thought, "Well, I'm awake and I have tubes going in and out of me and I'm breathing, and does that mean I could still die?" And it was the scariest thing in the world to not only hear it, but to have to try to process it then in a hospital room by myself, no one else in the room.
You know, it's interesting that certainly there are times when, as technicians, doctors can be absolutely marvelous and true lifesavers. But sometimes I think they get so caught up in the business of the work they're doing that they forget that there's a real live human being who's listening to their words, which for them may be offhanded,
right,
and may be supportive, but for the person who's listening, it can be pretty scary.
Right. I mean, and I, you know, maybe they don't even consider that okay, let me say this the right way. You know, there I am, just awake and becoming aware of what's happened to me, while doctors have been talking to family members for maybe a week now by that point, you know. And it's just so surreal to kind of hear those and process it. It was funny. I was talking to my husband the other night, and for some reason, the moment of the car accident, when the actual accident occurred, came up, and I said to him, I didn't even know it was bad at that moment of the crash. I remember thinking, "Oh man, now I'm not going to get home in time." And then after that, there's a tooth laying on my tongue, and you know, so the mind's ability to not understand what is happening to the body can be overwhelming sometimes too.
And sometimes it's a safety mechanism,
right,
that you're not fully aware of all that it's happened. Let's go back before the accident, because you begin in your memoir, Permanent Marker, talking about a marriage that you had, and you described it, I thought, in a really interesting way, truly the way that a writer would describe something. You said that your relationship had gotten lost in the woods of your youth. Over time, and I quote, "we learned to cling to the rotting branches of immaturity while stumbling over exposed roots on the trail of who was right and wrong. That is so beautifully, poignantly written. Tell us about that relationship that had gotten lost in the woods of your youth.
Well, you know, as a teacher, I see students who fall in love all of the time as teenagers. And I have become a little bit bitter about that over the years, because I feel like someone should have said to me way back when I was 17 or 18, hey, you know, maybe this isn't the relationship you should be in for another 20 years. You know, maybe you need to grow up and get out there a little bit and travel and get more education and date, actually, you know, meet more people before you settle on one person when you're 17 and you don't even know who you are, let alone maybe understanding what love is. And so I think that is what I'm trying to explain when I say getting lost in our youth, because I feel like if you go into a relationship with the mentality of a 17-year-old, and I saw it in my own relationship, that same mentality stays, right? We didn't grow out of that. We were still always 17 with each other, even when we were in our late 30s. And, you know, and I'm talking about like when we would argue and things. It never changed from, we might have grown up and matured, but I'm not sure our relationship grew the way it should have.
Do you think that at the age of 17 that you would have actually listened if someone had given you the advice that you now wished you'd received?
Right. No. They don't listen to you. I wouldn't have listened to it. You have to live and learn, I suppose. And it's so cliche to say, even, I wish someone would have told me, or I wish my mother would have sat me down. But you know, I can remember when he gave me a ring. I was only, I think I was 18, maybe going on 19. And it was Christmas time. And it was the Christmas that we had gotten a VCR, because everybody was downstairs watching movies, except for my mom. She was on the couch watching or reading a book. And he actually went downstairs with the family and left me with the package. And I opened it by myself and found this ring and walked into my mom and said, Mom, is this an engagement ring? And she said, oh, honey, that's between the two of you. And, you know, I'm not going to put it on my mom either. But at the same time, she had the perfect moment to maybe say, aren't you a little young for that? But that kind of encapsulates right there our relationship, to that was the moment when I had to try to figure out whether I was being proposed to.
And, you know, that just speaks volumes about communications, because that's
right.
Really a very interesting way to sort of propose, but not
right.
Really.
And again, we were young. You know, I think he would probably laugh about it with me now, but clearly I hang on to that memory.
In great detail.
Yes.
You, at one point in your relationship, and it didn't just happen overnight, it happened over time, you wanted your independence from the relationship, and you felt guilty because you say that you were perceived as being selfish. Talk about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I should have probably listened to my friend who did tell me, you know, people are going to think you're selfish if you go through with this, and meaning getting a divorce. But I didn't realize that people would just make up their own minds about things and think that they understood everything and, you know, ignore me the way that I was kind of cast out from this small town. It seemed like people chose sides, whether they were team Amy or team him. And, you know, I wanted to be me. I think that's another part of what happened in going into the relationship as a teenager, because at least for us, we we started dating in high school. I went away to college. He ended up transferring to the same college. Then we started living together, I think my second year of college. So I went straight from home to being, you know, to living with him. And as I started to grow and experience other things, I liked being Amy, the person, and not just Amy, the wife, Amy, the young mother. And yet at the same time, to be very clear, my children mean more to me than anything in the whole world. So there was another bit of that, the selfishness, that kind of felt like that was being put on me too. Like I wasn't thinking of my children. That caused a lot of guilt.
Was there anything that family members said to you as you moved towards getting this divorce?
No, actually, my family was very supportive. My father and mother basically told me they had seen it coming, and they supported me anyway, you know, that I needed help. My sister was very young when I started dating him, and so he was like a big brother to her, and she might have taken it the hardest, but she also said, you two just you're not good together. But she was more concerned about the kids than anyone else. But no, I did not deal. I had a very supportive family during that period.
You know, as you talk about the children, it's interesting how many people, even potentially listening to our conversation today, have been where you were, wanting to end a relationship for any number of reasons, but choosing to stay specifically and solely because of the children. What do you want folks who make that choice to think about, if anything?
I think it's possible. I won't put absolutes, but I think it's very possible that you could do more harm to the children by staying together than by splitting apart, because ultimately my kids recognize that I was much happier taking care of me and splitting apart from him. And eventually, once he got past the anger, they can see that he's happy now. And so I think it's a cautionary tale to say, well, I'm just going to stick it out for the kids, because I'm not sure what that teaches the children. They're not stupid. You know, they can pick up on what's going on in a relationship too. And so you're setting an example for them. That was another thing that I was concerned about. You know, do I want my daughters to, you know, he is the father of my children. We're friends. You know, we grew up together. I'm not talking bad about him. I'm just saying that in terms of what I wanted for them for future relationships, I didn't know if I wanted it to be someone like their dad, or did I want my son to grow into someone, you know, and for at the same time, me and who I was in the relationship, you know, do they want to understand that this is the way people get along in a marriage, that they constantly fight with each other and pick at each other over little things? And so I think it's important to try to weigh everything very carefully before a decision like that is made in terms of children.
Well, you know, as you said, children are sometimes, much to a parent's chagrin, smart, and they get it, and they see what's happening. And you're right, in those situations, and I know every situation is different, and human beings are incredibly complicated in a lot of ways, but when a child sees you in a marriage that is fraught with discord, that you're mm-hmm. unhappy, that the other parent is unhappy, you teach them a lot of things. You teach them that you don't have a right to be happy. You teach mm-hmm. them that it's okay to be kind of miserable for the children. And it's putting a lot of pressure on the children. When they have that experience that, well, mom and dad are staying together because of us. You know, on the one hand, children may say that they want their parents to stay together because of them, but underneath it all, that's a huge burden to place on your children.
Right. I agree.
What were the days like for you immediately after telling your husband and your children that you wanted a divorce?
Those first few days were very strange because, like I had thrown down the gauntlet and said, "Okay, I want a divorce," and there was no discussion afterward. He came and went and ignored me. I went to school the next day. He went to work. The kids went to school, and that went on for a couple of days, until that Saturday. I think I told him I wanted a divorce on a Tuesday evening or a Wednesday evening, and then that Saturday, I came home and there was no one there, and I was talking to my mom on the phone, and I just started feeling very sick, and ended up rushing to the hospital, and I was having a heart attack. So the first few days, I can't say. I guess it must have been a stress that I was holding in because there was no conversation happening in the home. When I look back on it, I think it was just a quiet few days, people walking around on eggshells, and it must have done a lot more damage than I realized even at the time.
It's interesting that the way your husband responded to the divorce was essentially the same way that he responded to the proposal. I mean, he did them both in silence. It also speaks to, just in terms of the stress that you were dealing with, it speaks to the power of being able to have real life dialogue with people.
Well, that's a good point. I mean, we were both early 40s, and why couldn't we have a conversation about it? Why couldn't we, even if he was angry and I was nervous about it, why was it pushed away so that there was no conversation? I mean, and I don't even know what we were waiting for, because if I hadn't had the heart attack, would there have been a conversation? We would have had to figure something out.
Or nothing, perhaps, in terms of your then husband's plan. There's no way of knowing.
Oh.
Even,
You
I mean,
mean like if we don't talk about it, it won't happen?
yeah, it'll go away.
Oh, that's possible.
There are people who function that way, and while that never works, it is certainly a plan of action for some folks. Inaction is the same thing as action in a lot of ways. You're still making a statement.
That is true.
You, at one point in the hospital, I mean, I'm interrupting myself to just sort of observe out loud that you had some really interesting comments from people in the medical profession. You were in the hospital, you had had a heart attack, is that, I mean, that's what you were diagnosed with, and the intensive care nurse told you that you'd had the perfect heart attack.
Yeah,
What is a
it was
perfect heart
now.
attack?
Good question. I do want to tell you though that real quick because I had to change his name in the book since I didn't get him to sign off on a release. But my doctor that performed the heart catheterization, his name was Dr. Bacon, and I just have to make sure that I say that because the irony is wild. But I'm in intensive care, and the doctor came in and explained what they had done to me and that there had been no significant damage, that what they thought happened was an artery, oh, it had ripped, the artery walls had kind of torn away and caused the heart attack to happen from stress and high blood pressure. And it had repaired itself by the time they went in to do the catheter, arterial dissection, that's what he called it. And he explained all this to me, and he left the room. And the nurse that was in there with me said, "Wow, sounds like you had the perfect heart attack." And I remember saying, "Well, what do you mean? Heart attacks are bad." And she said, "Well, very little damage. It's repaired itself. You didn't have any blockage, and with some rest, you'll be fine."
It's amazing.
And yeah,
It's amazing.
exactly,
Amy, we're going to
exactly.
take a break, and when we come back, I want you to tell us a little bit about broken heart syndrome. Is that a thing? Is
Okay.
it not a thing? Folks, this is Pamela Brewer, and you're listening to Mind Talk, and I'm having a conversation with Amy Ross. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Amy, tell us about broken heart syndrome. What is that?
Broken heart syndrome. I don't have any of my notes in front of me, so I'm going to do this off the top of my head because the Japanese name is I'm going to get that wrong. Okay. Broken heart syndrome. It comes from a Japanese word that means octopus trap, because that's what the heart looks like when this happens. But it is your body mimicking the symptoms of a heart attack from some extreme stress, anxiety, emotion. And it usually happens in middle-aged to older women, I found out. And a lot of times it's if someone that you're very close to dies, or if there's a traumatic event, this can happen. And I found out that it was a very real thing. And even a couple of years ago, I went to my cardiologist I have to go once a year to keep the checkups going and keep the meds going for the high blood pressure. And I had to see a different doctor. And he came in and was flipping through my chart and said, "So you had some sort of cardiac event," he said. He did not say heart attack, he said event. And I said, I knew it. Was it broken heart syndrome? And he said, "Well, you know, we're not going to actually call it that, but that is something that it could be. It has been studied more and more," he said, "but you know, you had some sort of cardiac event." So, you know, I don't know whether that was enough for me to say, aha, maybe I caused my own heart attack because of my broken heart. But I certainly think that stress, high blood pressure, anxiety, it all kind of fits with what I read and researched.
Well, let's see now. You told your husband, you told your family that you wanted a divorce. You mm-hmm. then had the perfect heart attack. Nothing else could go wrong. I mean, you were dealing with a divorce, you were dealing with children, you were dealing with people being angry with you and saying that you were selfish for wanting to have a divorce. Nothing else could possibly go wrong, right? I mean, you were under enough stress already. Life was then smooth sailing.
Right. And then the car accident. 5 months to the day after the heart attack, I was driving girls home from dance camp, about 20 minutes up the road. I decided that we would be commuters that year. And we were T-boned by a car that flew through the intersection, ignored the stop sign, had to have been speeding. He T-boned the car right at my driver's side, front tire. And that's where we began our conversation with all of the injuries that I sustained. The girls were okay. I always feel like as I'm telling my story, I let it go too long to let people know what happened to them. But the three girls that were in my car ended up, they did have injuries. The girl who was sitting up front with me, she had her nose broken. And then a couple days later at home, as she was recovering, she got dizzy after being in the bathroom and fell against the door and broke her nose in two more places. The girl in the far back corner of the car had no injuries whatsoever. And the girl that was sitting right behind me, she took the brunt of the glass when the glass shattered from the car. It went into her forehead and corner of her eye. And she was also lifelighted because they didn't know about internal damage to her, but she was okay. And she had plastic surgery on her forehead. The young man that hit us, only 19, from a neighboring school district, he died in a car accident. He was launched through the sunroof of the car and landed on the road. And he was declared brain dead either that night or the next day.
How old were the girls?
I think the girls were, two of them were not old enough to drive yet, because it took the girl that was in the front seat with me, she did not get her license until a year after she was able to because of the car accident. So they were maybe juniors in high school.
Okay.
One of them was a sophomore. So we're probably 15 and 16 years old.
Do you have any recollection of what was going on for you at the moment of impact?
In terms of driving?
Just what was going through your head at the point that you were hit. Do you have any, or what was going through your spirit? Do you have any sense of what you might have been thinking or feeling?
Well, I remember impact. I remember lights and then impact. And the next thing that I recall after that was I knew my tooth was laying on my tongue. I knew that my tooth had been knocked out. I do also remember thinking, oh man, we're not going to get home for a while. And then there was a man talking to me through the window, and I couldn't respond to him for some reason. He was asking me questions like, are you okay? And I remember that I couldn't speak. Like, I opened my mouth to talk, but nothing was coming out. And the girl behind me, she started yelling, that's Amy Young. She's been in a car accident, she's had a heart attack before. And then the next thing that I can remember was people trying to remove me from the car. And I tried to move my shoulder to get to the window to where I saw arms. And I heard a voice inside the car that said, stop moving or you're going to die. And so I stopped moving with the realization of, uh-oh, this is worse than I thought it was. And then the next thing that I really recall is being like on my back and looking at the sky. And my ex-husband was there, his head popped over my face, and he told me I was going to be okay. And he told me that he loved me. And then I remember being put into the back of a helicopter. Now, there's a gap of time there that I've found out that I was actually taken to a hospital where they checked me out, and then they flew me from the hospital. But for me, that's the series of events that happened. And it was boom, 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 you know, right after the other.
You talked about the young girl in the car being life-flighted to the hospital and that you were life-flighted to the hospital. What does that mean?
We were put into helicopters that flew us to trauma hospitals. I'm not sure where they took her, but I was flown to Cleveland Metro Trauma Center.
And you also talked about a wound vac. What is that?
A wound vac is a sort of vacuum that's hooked up to a sponge that's placed in whatever wound that they're trying to heal. And it's supposed to increase the oxygen flow to the wound and help it heal better. And they had cut me open to perform emergency surgery and remove my spleen. And I had a lot of internal bleeding as well. So they had to pack me with whatever they pack you to stop the bleeding. And so in the days immediately following those surgeries, they had put a wound back in to help. I could have chosen to get closed back up again, but I instead left the wound back in place because the doctor that talked to me about it really didn't give me any which way I should go on it. So I didn't want to go through another surgery. So I kept the wound back in. It was in my right in the middle of my belly.
You know, as you described that conversation with the doctor where he told you that you had the choice of another surgery, and when you asked for his guidance, he told you pretty much that it was six of one, half dozen of the other. So on the one hand,
yeah,
I understand the concerns about a potential malpractice suit, and that it really has to be the patient's decision. On the other hand, you know, when you're talking to somebody who has no idea what you're talking about,
right,
and no idea of the ramifications, it gets to be really difficult to give you no information, and so you're making a decision really based on no information.
Right. And the one thing that he did say was there was maybe a 20%, 25% chance that I could get an infection if I went back into surgery. And that is really the only kind of fact that he gave me because, you know, I said, well, is this wound going to close up on its own? Oh, yeah, of course it will. But not telling me how it might look. And I remember finally saying to him, well, what would you do? Oh, well, you know, it really doesn't matter. You can pick whichever one. Now, months later, to really go into how I had no information. Months later, when I had a follow-up appointment, I was still on the wound vac. So I shouldn't say months later. It was probably a month later. I had to go in for a follow-up appointment on my wrist, my broken wrist. And it was, for some reason, it was the plastic surgery checkup part of the trauma floor that I went to. And then when the nurse saw that I was on a wound vac, she said, is that why you're here? And I said, no, it's for my wrist. She said, oh, you'll be back for that probably in a few months. Well, I didn't know what she meant by that. And then in a couple months, when the wound vac was finally gone and the scar was there, and it was this horrific, ugly, awful scar, of course, then I thought, well, I probably should have had the surgery to have them close me back up in the hospital when he told me that day. But again, he gave me no information to go on.
You know, I'd love to see your book as part of required reading for medical students. And certainly medical students who are looking at the ethics of medicine. Because it's, you know, it's a dicey situation, and I think we understand both sides of it, certainly, but it's a challenge. I'd love to see every single medical school pick up this book and make it required reading for their students.
That would be interesting. I've never thought about that angle of it.
Yeah. Would love to see it in hospitals, particularly for folks who are doing ER work. Again, to look at I think it would be a wonderful teaching tool. So maybe that's something that can happen at some point, because I think your book is invaluable in so many ways, because there's so many lessons that one learns reading Permanent Marker. But certainly one of the lessons, I think, many of the lessons perhaps are for members of the medical community to really be medical and mental health, to really be mindful of what you're saying to someone and the language that you use. Language absolutely matters.
Right.
You know, you described your son Connor coming in to visit you, and my goodness, you had tubes coming from almost every part of your body. What was that like for Connor? Do you know?
Yeah, and I remember he and I were just talking about this the other day. I don't think he really remembers coming to see me. He was only 10 and he's about to turn 19. So, but he is reading the book too, and I asked him, "Did you get to your part yet?" And he just grinned at me, and I said, "Do you remember coming in to see me?" And he said, "No, not really." And I said, "Well, I remember you walked in." They wouldn't, first of all, they wouldn't, none of my family would let him come. And I think it was more of a shielding him and protecting him. They didn't want him to see me immediately after the car accident because I was so filled with fluids. They said I didn't look like me. And I, of course, wasn't awake. When he finally came to see me, I remember him walking in the room, and it was like he kind of stayed on the outer perimeter and just kind of circled the bed and looked at me. And because I didn't have a front tooth, and I, like you said, I had tubes coming out from underneath my arms where my lungs had been punctured, and I had IVs and catheter and the wound vac and everything. And I called him over to sit on the bed. And he sat there with me, and he was okay. It was mom. But I remember asking him after several years after that, do you remember what you were thinking that day? And it was while I was in the process of writing the book. And he said, "I just remember thinking my mom's going to die." And so that's what I had in my head as I tried to recreate that scene was and to be a 10-year-old boy to walk in and see your mother like that. What you must think.
The other thing that I think about, if your book ever does find its way to medical personnel, is also the folks who do medical social work and psychologists who are working in medical environments, because it's really, I mean, that's traumatizing for your child. And it's really important to have somebody talk to the child or the children, to family members, to help ease their trauma. So there's a lot that I could see really coming out of Permanent Marker. Talk about the as you found yourself being released from the hospital, what was that like for you in those early days?
I remember the car ride home from the hospital. I think I had my head out the car window the entire 1 hour and 15-minute drive home because I had been cooped up in the hospital for a month and I missed the sunshine and fresh air. I remember that they had in physical therapy had done different things with me to help me be able to get around, but it was no match for what I really had to encounter. Getting home from the hospital and oh boy, just being able to get in and out of my bed with this huge gaping wound in my midsection, and once I would climb into my chair out of my wheelchair, that I would stay there all day long. My mom came to take care of me, and she really took care of me. I mean, she cooked me breakfast every morning. She made sure I had my meds. She helped with anything that I needed. But then again, I was a 41-year-old woman that had my mom living with me after I'd just gotten a divorce and a brand new place to start over. So that was also, it was one of those things where I knew I needed to be taken care of, but I didn't want to be taken care of.
Sure.
I wanted to start my life.
So much that was so difficult for you to deal with. We're going to take a break, Amy, but when we come back, I'm going to ask you to walk us through your own process as you thought about and worked on your own healing with respect to the 19-year-old who changed your life forever in so many ways. So that's where we'll pick up when we come back. Folks, you are listening to Pamela Brewer on Mind Talk, and I'm having a conversation with Amy Ross, who is the author of Permanent Marker. Don't go away.
up. Shut up.
Us about the 19-year-old who, as I said before the break, changed your life forever, the young man who was driving the car.
Where should I begin? I found out from my brother that he was not someone that I knew. That was one of my biggest concerns, was that a 19-year-old that maybe I had in school had been the person that was driving. I was also concerned from the very beginning that it was someone who had been under the influence, and no one really would answer that for me. I don't know that they knew. What I found out in the months after the car accident was that, well, my brother actually told me that he was not someone, he was from a different school district. And then about 4 months after the car accident had happened, the police came to let me know that what the toxicology report said, that he was had marijuana and benzodiazepine in his system. And my sister's a pharmacist, so she kind of gave me the lowdown on what that might have done to him in terms of the reaction of the drugs. But what I also proceeded to find out was that he was quite a party boy. My girls told me not to look on Facebook, but of course, I did, and the kids that knew him had posted a memorial page to him, and all of these pictures of the partying that they had done together. And in picture after picture, you could see him holding joints and blowing smoke at the camera. And of course, there were stories posted about all the great parties that they had thrown together and so forth. And so all of these things added up and just maybe made my anger even worse than it already was for what had happened. And I had a real hard time processing that. When I went back to school in January, so the car accident was in July, and I went back half of the way through the year, there were kids in my class that had been friends with him. And I remember my daughter coming into my room one day. She was a senior, and there were kids sitting down in the cafeteria at her table talking about him and how much they missed him. And she was so uncomfortable with that because, you know, there she's dealing with, those were her friends, but what he had done to her mother. And so anyway, I dealt with this anger that just kind of continued to grow and grow and grow. And had one of his friends tell me that spring, that's kind of a long story. One of his friends ended up telling me that he admired me for what I had gone through, but we didn't talk about him so much.
Okay.
But the anger grew, and yet there was some guilt there for me too. Somebody died. He was somebody's son, you know, and it grew into this beast of post-traumatic stress disorder that I was diagnosed with within a year after the car accident.
What did you ultimately do to aid in your own healing? You certainly couldn't talk to him. He had died in the car crash of his own making. So again, it's on the one hand, you have compassion because this is a young man, a child who has ended his life. On the other hand, this is a child who was driving essentially a weapon. And it became a weapon in large measure due to the fact that he was under the influence of many things. How did you deal with your own anger? Yes.
I started to write about the car accident after it happened. I started to write about it within 6 months, I think, of it happening. And but not really about him. I just wrote about the accident itself. And going back to school, when the kids would write, I would write along with them if they were writing. And I ended up writing about my scars, I remember. And so eventually, at one point, I thought, maybe I should go back to the scene of the accident and see if anything happens there. I was in the process of getting my master's degree and working on my thesis in writing about the accident. That's what I wanted to write about. It just kind of was overwhelming to me. This is what I had to sit and write and get it out of my system. And so when I went to the scene of the car accident that day, I was kind of thinking, oh, you know, I'm going to have this amazing moment and I'm going to forgive him. And I think this was probably 2 years after the car accident, and it's going to be fine, you know, because there was a cross put there by his friends. And well, I went there and nothing happened. Nothing happened. I drove there and I looked at it and I thought, well, so this is where the accident was, and decided just to drive home. And within a couple months after that, I remember I was sitting at my desk and I was flipping through my pictures on my phone for some reason. I had taken a picture of the crosses, and I thought, you know, I'm going to write him a letter. I know he'll never get it, but at least I can write him a letter. And that letter just came out of me. The pen didn't stop moving until the letter was complete. And it is actually almost entirely word for word, not even much revision to it, from the first moment that I wrote it to where it is published in the book now. And just, you know, kind of saying to him, you know, look what you did, and look what you did to me. But not only that, look what you did to your parents, you know. And just to kind of go back to the 19-year-old thing now, again, my son is going to turn 19 in a month. I can't imagine the loss, because he is a child, you know. And so the anger and the guilt turned from what this boy had done to me into what he had done to himself, to his family, even. And so the more I wrote about it, the better I started to feel. But I really, truly believe that it was kind of recognizing that I teach students who are about the same age, as they started to ask questions and want to process what happened to me, because they're curious and they're teenagers, that helped as much as the writing did, talking about it to students.
At the end of the letter that you wrote to him, what did you physically do with the letter?
Nothing. I kept it because what I started off writing with a pen got moved into the computer in a Word document. And I know what we tell people, what therapists tell people, write letters and then throw them away or light them on fire or put them in an envelope and put it somewhere. Mine became a file in my computer that's still there. It's still there 100% the way it was the day that I wrote it.
If there was something that you could say to his parents, what would you say?
I don't know. I would probably say that I'm sorry for what happened to him. And let that start the conversation. I think.
One of the points that is made throughout Permanent Marker is not only the very complex human existence that you live, that we all live in different ways. I mean, we all have complicated stories. But it's also your resilience, your resolve to literally put yourself back together. and move forward, that there really is life after tragedies. And honestly, you've had your fair share of tragedies. What is your life like today?
Oh, it's wonderful. I have a wonderful man who takes care of me each and every day, and he loves me and he accepts me and all of my flaws. My children have all grown up and have been very supportive of me telling the story. I'm going to be a grandma in the coming months, and my other daughter is getting married this summer. I have a wonderful house on a beautiful property where there's a running stream, and I have flower beds and a couple cats that I like to spend my time with now because the world is very scary out there, and I joke around about it, but I'm quite happy in my little corner of the world, taking care of weeding the flower beds and rocking on the front porch with a glass of wine, and reflecting on what I have and how thankful I am for what I have because of what I did go through.
The world is indeed a scary place for many people, and that you, I mean, it truly sounds like an idyllic environment. I'll be right over. It just sounds amazing that you are able to be at such peace, and experience such joy in your life today as we talk about the moments of completely the opposite of joy in days gone past. The actual process of writing your book, I was interested as with the advice that you received, which was to figure out the story you want to tell and why it needs to be told. So we understand the story that you wanted to tell, and you have told it well. Why did it need to be told?
I think that in the last couple of weeks as I've talked to people about the book, that's become even more clear to me, even though I've already finished it. And one of the things that I know for sure was that when I was questioning myself and whether I wanted to stay in that marriage, there were no books out there that I could find where so that I didn't feel like such a freak, you know, like I was out on an island by myself. I needed to know that there were other women that questioned that. And so that's important to me, that the story was for women. The other thing is that I came to realize through the process is that every one of us has a story, every single one of us. And unfortunately, and I hate to say this, but if you are someone who doesn't have a story yet, you will. And it's how we process the stories to share with each other so that we can, they're part of this human collective that helps each other get through those times. That became ultimately why I had to tell the story. And that became pretty clear a couple years ago. My mother was dying from cancer and wanted, you know, me to help her make sense of her, what was happening with her by talking about what happened to me, even though she'd witnessed everything. And so that's the why for my story.
Is there a way that folks can get more information about permanent marker?
I do have a blog. It is amyrossblog.wordpress.com. They can go to my blog and find information there. They could also find me on Facebook or Twitter. I'm also on Instagram, although, you know, that's where I post fun pictures of my cats. So,
Spell your name for us so they can actually get to your blog.
okay, sure. I'm sorry. It's AimeeRossBlog.wordpress.com.
Terrific. Amy, I have to thank you so much for spending time with us today and certainly for sharing your story with us. It is beautifully written on so many levels and a powerful read. And I hope you'll really think about trying to get it into the hands of some budding clinicians. I think it would be useful.
Yeah, I think that's a really good idea. And thank you so much for taking the time to speak to me today. It's always good to try to tell a little bit more of the story that maybe doesn't come out of the book.
Absolutely. Well, again, I thank you so much. And folks, I thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a medical or mental health professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26 by 2 Communications. If you would like to be in touch with me, I'd love to hear from you, your comments or your questions about today's program or any Mind Talk conversation. Send an email to me at Pamela, Pamela, at mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. And remember, Mind Talk is available online on demand at mindtalk.org. You can download the Mind Talk app from iTunes or Google Play. And as I said, please do be in touch with me and just let me know where you are in the world as you're listening to Mind Talk and what you'd like to hear us talk about next. And remember always, if it's unacceptable, that's what it is. Unacceptable. You take care.